I had to boil it down to one thing, would be to get all of those basic engineering practices right, because they're not really about engineering, but they're about communication, which is, you know, the focus really of this conversation about remote work versus in person. And to be honest, most of the focus of software.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Let's get to the real work. And today, I'm talking to Valentina Servile. Valentina is a lead software developer at ThoughtWorks, where she's worked for the past 7 years, and she's also the author of the book, Continuous Deployment. So Valentina, I'm super excited to have you on today.
I'm really excited to be here.
Could you start by sharing a little bit about your role at ThoughtWorks and how that gives you a perspective on remote work?
I don't know if most of the viewers will be familiar with how consultancies operate, but a lot of them, and ThoughtWorks is one, they basically have a lot of nearshore and offshore work. So by nature, a lot of our teams have to work in a distributed way because there might be perhaps one, perhaps more, perhaps most client developers that would be on site, and we would perhaps be an hour away or two if we're near shore, and we might be even several time zones away if we are completely offshore. So for example, we have delivery centers with teams in India and China and Vietnam, and so they will be working with other people basically on the other side of the world. So yeah, remote work comes up quite a lot, and I think that as a company, we've had basically over 20 years of experience doing that. Myself, I've been working in several teams in ThoughtWorks. I think I'm on my sixth or seventh one in my tenure here. And all of them, without exception, have been remote. I was never lucky enough to work with a local team for a local client, which also does happen. So yeah, I would say that I've had my fair share of remote work experience.
To that end, what aspect of remote work and how your team works together do you feel like you've really nailed?
One thing I really like about my teams is that usually for every engagement, so we set up a new team and we know they're going to be working mostly remotely. We try to set up the engagement in a way that we get everybody together, perhaps in one office, perhaps in the other. It doesn't really matter, but we try to have a kickoff, or sometimes they also call it an inception. And that's where we kind of look to build that initial trust that is really important between all the team members and the of course, management, whoever will be there as a stakeholder. So we try to kind of maximize that time because usually it's constrained by, you know, budget and, you know, people's lives and availability. But we try to push all of the important conversations in those few days that we are together and kind of establish a basic rapport that then I think it really pays off as people know each other, not just from a screen, but they've seen each other in person at least once. And they can start off the work with that baseline of trust and, you know, of course, clarity from having all of those conversations about what the product would be like. After that, we repeat this, even just for a day or two, if we can every quarter, but more likely every 6 months. It is good to periodically refresh this, right? To get everybody back together, you know, get them to eat dinner together, get them to a bar, get them to work, you know, face to face in front of the same screen at least once. It pays off so much in terms of trust. And especially as teams are not static, you know, members come and go and you have to go through all of the forming, norming, storming phases all over again.
I actually want to pause on this, Valentina, because almost everyone that I've spoken to is doing remote really well has some component of this. Getting together in person at the kickoff of major projects, major initiatives, at the moment of team formation, in the case that they're a consulting firm. And everybody sort of approaches that get together or the time spent together a little bit differently. Could we get a little bit specific and tactical about how much time do you spend together and how do you fill that time?
When we do the kickoff, usually we have workshops from the start of the day to the very end of the day. We usually start off with an agenda. I know it sounds really tiring, and I'm not going to lie, it is, but it's really worth it. You know, it's also energizing in a weird way besides being tired. I can recommend here Paolo Caroli's book, Lean Inception. That's a framework we often use where basically we decide, okay, what are the key things to decide about how this project is going to go? And it could be like a first draft of the product backlog. It could be what are your user personas that are going to be interested in your software. It could be, let's say, what are our milestones? So when are we good to release? What's our MVP? Or it could be other decisions, like what are our ways of working? How do we define that a ticket is done? Let's all agree on that upfront so that then we minimize the extra communication we have to have on all of these very sensitive conversations when, you know, we're distant and maybe communication is over text and we cannot really understand each other's intentions very well. So we try to get all that done before we actually start working. And then when we do our periodic catch-ups, usually we just work as we do every day. If there's a very important meeting coming up, we might intentionally schedule it to be happening on that day where we're all together, and perhaps we can even meet another team. But the one thing I always make sure to do is to have a room booked for the whole team to sit together. Because oftentimes in offices, you know, you travel all the way to see your colleagues and they've got a room and it's full and you have to sit somewhere else. It's happened. And it seems obvious, but it completely defeats the purpose. So, you know, you should always have somebody making sure that there's a physical space for you to collaborate.
Hopefully it goes without saying, but it's an easy detail to forget. So I get it.
It's happened many times.
that's funny. Okay, so you get together, it sounds like, for multiple days, maybe up to a week, mm-hmm. with the purpose of front-loading, it sounds like, all of the foundational questions about how you're going to work together on the one hand, but also some of the principal outlines of the work that needs to get done that is context-specific to that project, to the team's stated goal, so that folks have that shared understanding and alignment around what you're trying to do. Am I understanding that right?
Exactly. And it comes across much better in person, and then if I refer back to it later. I've also done this really nice exercise sometimes, which was, what are our team's values? I know it sounds really fluffy and like that sort of corporate culture that I'm a bit skeptical on, but I have to say, if you have to do some fluffy team building stuff, perhaps this is a good one. It really helped later on to, you know, always have it there as one of our artifacts, you know, close to our board where everybody could see it. And it contained, you know, inputs from everyone and stuff like, we are a team that is very open-minded. We want to, you know, accept everybody's suggestions and consider them carefully. Or we always show up to meetings on time. You know, it could be anything, but, you know, some just shared values of how we work together. And it could be even technical things like we value, for example, frequent deployment and frequent feedback over, you know, creating lots of documentation. You know, it just helps set that baseline and, you know, prevent discussions that are going to happen later over chat.
Before the recording, you and I were catching up and you shared that you're part of the platform team within ThoughtWorks and that in so doing, you have a certain duty to communicate to other folks internally. One of the things that we like to talk about on the show is how to communicate effectively in a remote context when in-person communication is not an option. We've talked a bit about that in-person communication and how to front-load it on the team level. Could you talk also about how your team communicates with other teams internally at ThoughtWorks?
With other teams, basically, since they're also mostly remote, or at least they are remote to us, we basically try to put so much extra attention on the way we frame things. So we try to always assume the best intentions, be very respectful of suggestions. One thing is, of course, as a platform team, we're trying to build products for developers by developers that should ideally be used as a service. So with that comes a very big burden of documentation. We try to, first of all, make the most out of our tools and out of automation so that documentation is not as necessary, so you don't have to read, 700 pages before you can use a library that we made or some kind of platform that we made. But even so, the documentation that we do have, we try our very, very best to keep it up to date, which removes a lot of unnecessary back and forth and unnecessary meetings popping up in our calendar with misunderstandings. So we try to cover all of the use cases with plenty, plenty of examples that are practical. And in addition to that, we try to also, whenever we're releasing something very new, we try to go team by team personally. So invite the whole team to a meeting, just the developers, not a big showcase, not a big demo, just try to explain what we did and have a very informal Q&A for any questions. Then finally, when it comes time to onboard someone to use a product that we used, if it's, let's say, complicated enough, then we will literally block out our calendar for, let's say, 1 day, 2 days, or even a week, depending on what it is, and literally sit with them, you know, to make the onboarding smoother. One thing that I really like about our onboarding is that we don't do anything for other teams. So we just basically let them have the keyboard and walk them through it and let them do things with their own hands so that, you know, they get a feel for how the products are used, and then they can be as autonomous as possible and they feel like they maintain the ownership of what they are building. So I'd say these are the main things that we try to do. I would say most of them are successful. You know, oftentimes we still receive a lot of inquiries, you know, on Slack, on meetings, but I think that's not avoidable.
We've talked about some of the stuff that your team and you personally practice, but we haven't gotten into any stories like of how some of the stuff comes up in practice. Where have you seen teams struggle the most when it comes to working effectively together?
I do have a very bad example of a team that we actually had to close pretty early on. And that's where we couldn't get together in person. I think it was not a coincidence personally, but it had many other dysfunctions as well. I would say one of the main ones was a lack of trust, I would say, between management and the team itself. It was a very particular moment in that company. So, I mean, I still want to be kind, like it's not a case of manager bad, you know, there were some legitimate reasons why trust couldn't happen. But because there wasn't, basically, there were a lot of anti-patterns that made people really struggle to work there. And some of those were, for example, the lack of pair programming, which is a very big topic again in the book. And perhaps we'll talk more about that later. But it wasn't just a lack of pair programming. It was a deeper issue where pair programming was seen as bad because then programmers couldn't be judged by their output in terms of tickets. So tickets would be assigned in the stand-up meeting to specific individuals at the discretion, basically, of management. There was maybe a little bit of negotiation. But then, you know, performance was mostly evaluated by people's output in tickets. And so what that led to was basically a day that looked like you join your stand-up, you get your work assigned to you with your name put on it especially, and then you're working in isolation the whole day. And, you know, you're kind of also afraid to reach out for help in case, you know, you have to block someone else from doing their particular work. And so it wasn't a very pleasant environment to work in because it's, I would say, even more isolating to not speak to anyone all day, even though you're remote. Actually, my expectation with remote is mostly the opposite, you know, that because I am far away, I have to communicate more, not communicate less. Unfortunately, we kind of closed this team because, I mean, as I said, it was a particular situation at the time with the company. So we withdrew from that engagement. But if I had to kind of give advice, especially to managers who might feel like, you know, with remote work, they have perhaps less visibility of what people are doing. And I think it's a very easy trap to fall into, especially, you know, if some people are not even your employees, they're perhaps even from a consultancy. In the end, you are kind of giving up some control, like you are not seeing people as they are in front of their keyboard at their desks. But I would argue that you can solve that with different tools rather than, you know, measuring productivity literally by tickets, or even worse, some companies do it by lines of code. So my advice would be to still, you know, again, meet in person as often as you can, try to build that rapport, try to see people face to face, but also you can instead measure the team's output, not by, you know, individuals' specific tasks, but by setting goals. For example, for your preferred cadence of time, say, every milestone, are we meeting those milestones on time as we promised? Or, you know, if you work with sprints because you like Scrum, then you can have a very specific goal for every sprint and, you know, kind of negotiate it with the team. Do you think we'll be able to get this part of the work done by 2 weeks' time, more or less? And, you know, hold the whole team accountable to meeting those goals, not just specific individuals. Another practice that I really recommend to managers who might be struggling is to do one-to-ones with their team members, because it kind of helps, you know, surface any issues. And if what you're worried about is not being able to look at people's performance, my recommendation is this. If somebody is not pulling their weight, you're going to know it if you're the manager of the team, right? Especially if you do one-to-ones. So it's not something to be concerned about to the level of really monitoring what people do every day. I mean, it will emerge because, you know, people feel frustrated if they perceive that a team member isn't contributing fairly. So it will definitely come up. And again, my last advice on this would be to try to do pair programming with the frequent rotations. And especially if you're a technical type of manager, so perhaps you're a tech lead, you're an engineering manager, if you actually sit down and work with someone, you're going to know at what level they are in their journey. If they're still a bit on the more junior side and they perhaps need more support and more help, but you're going to know besides from, you know, feedback from other colleagues of them.
I actually think that's a pretty interesting perspective of using pair programming as a management tool, because working side by side with your team can be a pretty effective way of understanding how well are they doing, you know, what are they struggling with, how eager are they to perform, and that sort of thing. And I don't think a lot of folks talk about pair programming as a management tool. In fact, I think a lot of folks think about it as something that managers tend to be against. And so I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
I'm kind of in a management-y position right now as a technical lead. I'm kind of also helping oversee other teams that are not my team. It really depends on your company's context, but I believe that all technical managers should code at least a little bit. And I feel that being part of the pair programming rotation is a really helpful tool, right? Because it really allows you to look into, you know, what each individual is thinking, what is their style of coding, you know, why you might be observing certain dynamics. So for example, if you see that somebody doesn't really want to pair, then just, you know, pair with them and figure out, you know, are they perhaps having some problems at home, or they just prefer another style of working? Do they, you know, maybe need an hour or so to think about a problem really deeply before they're ready to share? And so you might be getting a lot more insight into their performance and what is their level of proficiency with what you're working. I really recommend it as also as a management tool, except, you know, one-to-ones that I've already mentioned.
Earlier, you mentioned that when you're remote, your expectation is that you should be communicating more, right? Because you're not face-to-face, you're not right next to each other. And so you're going to need to over-communicate to get points across and to feel connected and aligned as a team. Pair programming is obviously a way that you could communicate with people more often. Do you think pair programming is more or less important when a team is remote?
I would say much more important when a team is remote, right? Obviously, if I'm in an office with someone and perhaps we're even sitting at the same table, I can just do this and have a look at what they're working on. And if I see some part of the code that I don't quite understand, I can ask them some questions. I mean, it's not that I'm nosy, but, you know, it just happens organically, I think, to everyone. But what I find super important is a sense of collective code ownership if you're working in a team. So when you're in a remote team and you don't have the chance to, you know, just to speak with your colleagues every day about the code you're making, I think pair programming is even more important because it really helps maintain that sense of ownership. You know, besides all the other benefits of it, like, you know, having synchronous feedback, having feedback much earlier than with PRs and so on, I think it really helps the team gel as well, much more than a team that is in an out remote setting. So, for example, what we have as a setup in this team and in many of the teams that I've been in before was this kind of always-on Zoom room or Teams room, it doesn't matter, that had kind of breakout rooms where we would organize our pairs, right? And of course, it had two functions. Like, one is the obvious, you know, that's where we connect in order to do work and we share our screen. But also it acted as kind of a water cooler space where everybody would always default to, right? So we kind of had an always-on space that we can always know we're going to find our colleagues, kind of like in a physical office. And that, because that's what I think is mostly missing from many remote setups, you know, having a place where, you know, your colleagues are going to be there as if you were in person. So what we do is we have a stand up, we have a coffee, and then right after we connect to the room and we see who's there and who we're going to pair with. And then we can kind of break off into our little pair. But we know that if we're looking for someone else, we don't have to send a Slack message and wait 40 minutes for them to get back to us. We just go in the rooms as if we would do in a physical office and literally look around, see who's pairing with who. And then we're able to reach them and ask them a question. Just pop in really quickly for 30 seconds and then go back to our own pair again. I think it's really efficient. I know I've kind of gone on a tangent from pair programming, but pairing together with this kind of setup, I think works really well because it kind of gives you almost a physical place to know where your colleagues are and what they're doing and kind of pop in for very quick communication that would otherwise be delayed. Everybody's had eyes on the code and hopefully you've changed your pairs perhaps a few times a week. So you kind of get away from that syndrome that I think you often have with remote is your little personal garden of code that nobody else is allowed to touch. That stops existing, which is a good thing, just clarifying. So basically, nobody feels especially attached to one part of the code over another, and nobody feels especially protective over one part of the code over another. So I think it really, really encourages healthy communication. It gives everybody a place to be if they're pair programming. So personally, I always try to do it with any team, even in person, but especially with a remote team.
That relates to one of the first things that you said, which was it contributes to this collective code ownership. Well, why is that important to you? Why do you think that makes a difference? Or how does that make a difference?
First of all, it's just a predictor of quality, right? Because if we start treating code like it belongs to everyone, that it is a group project, then it can always be improved. If I'm starting to feel possessive over a certain subsystem or function or class that I wrote, and perhaps I spent 2 days with my headphones working alone on it, then it is in me own from improving, because any suggestions that come towards it are basically an insult to the work that I did by myself and by my thought process. Whereas if I have actually just worked on it with someone else, it's something we made together, then suddenly it's opening it up to criticism and basically any improvements that want to be made on it. So that's why I think it's a predictor of quality, but also in more practical terms, it's just so much better for the longevity and the productivity of the team, right? So for example, let's say I worked on something by myself again for 2 days with my headphones and it breaks in production 3 months later and I'm on vacation, perhaps 3 months later. Who's gonna know how to fix it, right? Or perhaps even more simply, with nothing breaking, something needs to be added to it and perhaps I've left the company or I'm not there anymore. Suddenly management is in a bit of a pickle because nobody knows what I wrote and how it works. So just in order for the team to function properly and, you know, keep on living beyond the span of the tenure of any individual, I think collectively owning the code base and the product that you're working on, it gives much better and much more sustainable results in the long term.
I want to pause on this topic of collective code ownership for a second, because I would agree that it's important basically no matter what, but I think that in a remote context, folks are so much more likely to misinterpret messages and pieces of feedback that are communicated because you've had fewer opportunities to break bread with one another. You are communicating in a lower fidelity way, even if it's synchronous, because there's less body language, there's fewer conversations, between meetings, et cetera, et cetera. And so by doing things like bear programming or instilling a culture of collective code ownership, you reduce that risk of feedback being misinterpreted, which is inherently higher in a remote context. Yeah. And so I just wanted to pause and highlight that because I think that is so important to think about whether or not pair programming is the tool that you use to create collective code ownership. I think having that mentality, improving the likelihood that feedback is received positively and therefore that the team functions effectively together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think of even just the means, right, of pair programming. You know, you have to be on a call together. Ideally, you might even have the video on and, you know, you're actively discussing something, at least over voice chat, if nothing else, that's much better than text. And this is where I think we should talk about PRs for a minute because...
Please.
Yeah.
It's a hot topic that you care a lot about.
Most of my book is very technical, but, you know, I do bring up, you know, different ways of working as well. And I think with remote, again, reinforcing on this idea of pair programming being good, one of the main recommendations I make is to use it as a replacement to traditional pull requests. I believe that pull requests, especially in a remote setting, when you cannot sit together to review, then become much more harmful, right? So I've seen so many of my colleagues get really upset about something that I read, and I thought, actually, that's pretty benign and constructive. They felt very attached, obviously, to their design or they were misunderstanding the intentions behind somebody writing some kind of comment. And so I think overall, you know, besides it being more awkward, it's also introducing a lot more pauses and blockers in the workflow when you're remote. Because, you know, you can't simply go and tap someone on the shoulder and say, hey, I've sent a PR. Do you have a minute to check it with me and then we can merge it? You cannot do that. You have to send a Slack message or a Teams message and wait for that person to see it, schedule some time on their end to review the PR, look it through, leave their comments, and then you have to do it all over again when you want to address their comments and so on. So it just introduces so many delays and so many opportunities to be blocked and to be misunderstood that I think, you know, it's quite noticeable the improvement that you can make when you switch to pairing instead as a form of code review. So yeah, I know that there's an interest in saying this because you make pair programming software, but I'm a big advocate for it. And I think that it definitely makes teams work better when you're remote, and it just gives you also just more opportunities to work together, you know, in what feels closer to in person rather than being at the headphones all day.
What's the worst example that you've seen of a team leveraging PR reviews to their own detriment?
To be honest, I think it might have been that team that I already mentioned where, you know, everything had to be approved via PR and main was protected on top of it. So it wasn't just enough to have a PR made and, you know, somebody else seeing it. And then you could just even maybe merge it yourself or merge an urgent fix yourself. It was when PRs were also seen as a quality control, you know, mechanism from the manager side. I cannot tell you how annoying that was, you know, to always be blocked by one person in that case, you know, at least if you use PRs and you can auto-approve and auto-merge your own PRs, you know, it becomes optional to get feedback. You know, you should really get feedback, but you can still move forward if you got something urgent to do, or perhaps you've discussed in person and it's fine. If you have a protected main branch, that's it. You have one blocker in the team, and that blocker will have a name and a surname, and they're going to have a ton of things to do besides reviewing your PRs, so what's going to happen is that you'll be blocked, you'll start pulling work from somewhere else, increase your cognitive load, and then you get unblocked. Suddenly you've got two work items to be looking after. It's just absolute insanity that way. So,
Well, to play devil's advocate, I think a lot of companies work that way. I mean, I think a lot of companies have a very particular and strict process for reviewing, approving, and merging PRs. Why do you think that they do that, given you feel so strongly that it is not an effective way of running the process?
They probably are using PRs as a quality control gate by having a human review code before it gets merged, right? What I would like to maybe change people's mindset about is that human quality gates are a little bit obsolete. They could probably be replaced by automated ones. So if you're in a company that has no automated test coverage, has very tricky deployment processes that are very sensitive, very fragile software in production, you don't have code security scanning, you don't have performance scanning, then sure, I agree with your decision to manually approve each and every line of code that gets merged into main. That said, if you've got a deployment pipeline that has a lot of automated quality gates, even code style ones are possible, by the way. So if you're violating some kind of coding standards that you agree, that will, of course, get flagged. Then, you know, all of this strict approval becomes superfluous. And in fact, it becomes even dangerous because then you're creating a two-track process for normal changes and urgent changes, where urgent changes only get made, say, once a year, get through the pipeline immediately through a process that has not been tested every day. You know, it becomes a bit of a recipe for disaster. So, yeah, I would say human quality gates can be automated even around PRs. And definitely if you want to make sure that there's a second pair of eyes on every code change, you can do that again with pair programming.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Let's imagine you're a developer at a company that lives in that world, right? Where there is a PR process that requires approvals like we've described, which you've described as suboptimal for a variety of reasons. Let's assume that that company does have some of deployment pipeline that could enable better. What could you as an individual, or what could I as an individual developer on a team looking to do better do as a starting point to edge my team towards, you know, the beautiful vision that you've outlined of what better looks like?
All right. So my usual recommendation here is to make the process safer before you make it faster. And so to basically prioritize all of those safety practices. So pair programming as a code review system is one of them, but also static code analysis that I was mentioning, that's really important to catch defects that would otherwise be going through all of your environments and then to production. I would say work very hard on your automated test coverage. Perhaps you could even look at practices that aim to do the testing before the production code. So that would be TDD and so on, even outside in TDD. Try to maybe look at your test pyramid again, see do you have enough testing coverage at a certain layer. Some people, for example, often forget the higher layers where they do more elaborate tests on the system as a whole or even as it is interconnected with other systems. So I would prioritize those practices and also add, finally, feature flags and a good feature flag system as a means to secure work in progress under, you know, a gate of some kind that doesn't require, you know, version control branches to be hidden away. But it is another type of gate that is equally, if not much more controllable, to be honest. So once you have all of that, you can start, I think, looking at speeding up your process. So maybe that's where you start removing approvals now that you see that they become basically redundant because you have all of these gates automatically checking each of your changes. So I would say that's when you can start removing approvals from things like PRs, but also when you're testing in an environment like staging, perhaps you don't need to do as much testing, or you can even think to automate the final deployment from, you know, staging to production.
Well, making it safer before it's faster feels like a really easy thing to remember as like a methodology or a framework for this. And so I really, really like that. And the tactical examples hopefully help folks, if they do want to, you know, edge towards the world that you're describing, have a little bit of a mental model for how to get there. I want to shift gears a little bit. What do you think is the most important thing for remote teams to get right?
All right. I would say maybe keeping the cognitive load of the team small, because that's what keeps conversations small and straightforward. How I like to do that is by using engineering practices on the technical side that are really straightforward. And usually, again, they are the ones that come from XP. So again, pair programming, but also using CI and CD properly in a very simple way, you know, kind of going back to those basics that are meant to address the huge cognitive load and pain of writing software and doing handovers and doing back and forth with all sorts of people, all sorts of approvers. Trying to go back maybe to some literature that was written even 20 years ago, it really shows that you can simplify your development process in a way that also benefits remote work, perhaps even more so than it benefits in-person work, because you are, again, reducing all of these opportunities for misunderstandings and all of these opportunities for diverging ideas about what the state of the code base looks like and what the state of production looks like. Suddenly you can collaborate in a much simpler manner where your pair programming on everything, all of the recent changes are on Trunk. So at a glance, you can tell exactly what the other pairs have been up to just by pulling the latest. You don't need to go and check out which other branches they might have made. You're in a state where you know what the state of production is because you haven't deployed it 6 months ago, but perhaps you've deployed it yesterday or even this morning, and it's actually quite close to the code that everybody knows now and understands now. And most importantly, you're not working in a silo. So you are meeting with your colleagues very frequently. You're hopping from pair to pair really frequently. I think this, to me, is the ideal state of a team that works remotely. I had to boil it down to one thing, would be to get all of those basic engineering practices right, because they're not really about engineering, but they're about communication, which is, you know, the focus really of this conversation about remote work versus in person. And to be honest, most of the focus of software to me as well.
What's the highest performing team you've ever been a part of?
I think the one I'm on right now is very, very good. One of the best teams I've been on. It's quite small as well, so that also helps because we're just three people. But now I've been working also with a team of 12 people that was really good. It was a really healthy balance of senior people, but also juniors and graduates. And honestly, it was a pleasure to work with because everybody kind of knew we wanted to align on all of the base engineering practices and keep, you know, the code base, the pipeline production as straightforward as possible. And everybody was kind of rowing in the same direction instead of opposite directions.
It seems like having this shared understanding of engineering practices, adhering to some of those basics that, as you said, are derived from XP or extreme programming, is kind of the foundation of a high-performing team to you. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's also a good foundation of a team that works well remotely as well as in person, because it's hard to mess up, you know, engineering if you follow those practices literally. You know, a lot of them are focused on safety. It's like small releases, tests everywhere, very, very frequent integration, very frequent checking. So, you know, it really removes all of those opportunities for remote work to go badly by following these very simple practices.
What's one question about remote work that you don't have the answer to yet?
It perhaps is a simple one, but I want to know how to really take more breaks with my team, because there's so many notifications everywhere with remote work. And everybody's working kind of on different schedules with their own team. So I'm getting notifications from my own team, from people we reached out to last week, from people that are in other teams and they need a hand. For me, I still haven't answered this question. It's really hard to disconnect. I still haven't figured out really how to balance the amount of information that comes in a remote setting with the tasks I have to do every day. It becomes really overwhelming sometimes because, you know, physically we're only able to be in one place at once. And we're only able to have one conversation at once. But if I have Slack open or GChat or Teams open, I can be asked a question by 7 different people in the same minute. And that often happens. So, you know, I've tried things like the Pomodoro technique, but I feel like that was very, very prescriptive. Still don't have an answer to that one, but I'm happy to receive tips if anybody in our viewership wants to reach out.
I think this is a pretty common challenge. You're inundated with information from 100 different places when you're working remotely, and keeping up with it at all while still getting work done is definitely quite challenging. If anybody listening has a good tip for how to approach this or a tool that helps manage this, we'd certainly be very interested. Write in and we'll get it featured and try it out ourselves, I think. Well, we're coming up towards the top of the hour here. And so I just want to say thank you so much, Valentina, for making time to chat and being generous with sharing your perspective. It goes a long way. What's one thing, if anything, that you want listeners to take away from this conversation?
Do pair programming.
If you haven't said it enough, you'll hear it again. Do pair programming. I love it. And if they'd like to learn more about you or ThoughtWorks for that matter, where should they go?
I have a book on Amazon. You can find me also on LinkedIn, where you have a bit of my bio and so on. And ThoughtWorks has a website where you can find also my book or any other case studies. You just type thoughtworks.com and there they are.
Very good deal. Well, we'll link out to each of those places in the show notes so folks have it. Thank you again, Valentina. Hope to catch up again soon.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @Tuple on X or visit distributed.fm.